So on this record, Mona and My Babe, what kind of equipment did Dove have at that point in time?
I'm pretty sure that was recorded on their four-track machine.
Four-track, okay. Do you have any idea how many of the 45s were sold?
I don't. Typically, though, pressings were done 1,000 at a time. If a record was selling really well, it might sell 1,000 records. Sales were almost always just local. So, you know, the Twin Cities and maybe some of the surrounding cities in neighboring states. But a big selling 45, you know, we're certainly not talking millions of records.
Do you recall playing for the Dayton's Top 10 shows?
Yeah, we did that at least one time.
What was that like?
It was often kind of a madhouse. The Dayton's people were wonderful. They had a well-organized special events group. The 8th Floor Auditorium was really kind of a nice place to play, and they had a good stage and everything. But after you played, and by the way, those were usually broadcast live, or there was a disc jockey up there, and so it was a big production. But then you had to go into a little corner and sign autographs, and sometimes that got a little out of hand. Kids would be pretty wild and kind of on top of you. But honestly, it was, you know, kind of the closest most of us bands got to feeling like we were really something.
Now, clothes were a big deal at that point in time.
Yeah.
What kind of clothes did TC Atlantic wear on stage?
We went through a real British mod phase. There was a shop in Dayton that imported things from England. And I remember that we bought several outfits up there.
Was that Carnaby Street?
Yep. That's what it was.
So could you describe a little bit what you guys looked like? The clothes?
We had some double-breasted gray jackets. We had blue shirts that I think had white collars. We had real wide floral ties. We had big flared bottom pants. We had an outfit that had black lace front shirts, like pirate shirts. We had some striped pants at one point. We had three or four outfits that we could alternate. And I think we dressed like that for a good year or more, maybe a year and a half.
Now, when the band played live, did you have a sound guy with you?
No, nobody had a sound guy with us. We had two kids that were our band boys. They helped carry things in and out. They helped set things up and take them down. Most bands had their own PA system, which would have been speakers, an amplifier, and we owned our own microphones. You set everything up. If you were lucky and had a few minutes, you did kind of a sound check on your own, and then you played. And as the night went on, you just kept turning things up until they squealed, and then you turn them down a little.
Now, you said you got a drum set from B Sharp. What mm-hmm. kind did you get?
I had a Rogers set. It had a bass drum, floor tom, two toms, and a snare drum. And I always used two ride cymbals. That set, I think, was a kind of what they called champagne pearl. It was a pinkish tan kind of sparkly finish. Pretty set of drums.
So what were the other guys using as far as instruments, guitars, and keyboard?
The best that I can remember, Joe always played a Fender bass with a Fender amp. Freddie had a Farfisa organ. And then I'm pretty sure that later he added a piano on top of that. Probably a Hohner, but I don't really remember. He had a Fender amp. Bob, I want to say, played a Guild guitar. But again, I'm kind of guessing, and I don't remember from the photographs whether he had a Guild or something else. Did he have a Rickenbacker? Yeah. Bob went through several guitars. Guitar players like to collect guitars and play different guitars. I remember he had a 12-string for a little while that we used and, you know, went through a number of different axes. Joe, I think, always played a Fender bass.
Now, with Mona on the radio stations, both of the big ones in town, did that affect the popularity of the band?
Sure, record play on radio always helped you. When you went to dances, people would ask you to play that song. Frequently, you'd record a song because people already liked it. And that was the case with Mona. That was a good song on stage. People liked it. It was a good dance song. From the time that we recorded that in 66 until the time that we did our live album in 67, you can hear the evolution of the song, which is kind of fun. Mona became a longer production on stage. It had a long kind of almost like a breakdown in the middle where Joe did some ad-libbing and stuff, threw in pieces of Hey Little Girl in a High School Sweater and some other stuff. It kept the Mona Bo Diddley beat going all the way through, but it became a much more interesting song to play.
All right, so the next record that you're involved in is what and when?
Faces in 1966 in the summer, and that was backed with Baby Please Don't Go, another little R&B thing. Faces was interesting because it was written by Freddie and Joe.
Had they been writing songs?
Yeah, they'd been monkeying around with writing for a while. This was the first song that I can remember ever playing that they wrote, and it was certainly the first song that they wrote that we recorded. Faces had a real Indian music influence. Joe had been playing sitar. He took some lessons on sitar. This was when
made popular by Ravi Shankar,
right.
Shankar, who was a good friend of George Harrison.
Yes, yep. I think most people here first learned about Indian music through the Beatles. A funny side note, Dayton's once asked if anybody could come to the store and play sitar in one of the little boutique areas where teenage clothes were sold. And Joe was asked if he'd come and play. Joe had probably had six lessons on sitar. Sitar is an incredibly difficult instrument to master. It takes a lifetime to master sitar. Joe knew how to hold it, and he knew some of the words, but he didn't really know how to play very much on it. It's sort of like asking somebody who'd been taking piano lessons for 6 months if they'd come and play someplace, play a, you know, a recital.
But it worked.
It worked because Joe, well, for one thing, nobody knew what a sitar sounded like, and Joe asked me to come with him and play drums. Now, Indian drums are called tabla. I didn't have a tabla, and I have no idea how to play one. Again, they're incredibly difficult to play. But I took my bongo drums apart and just took the big drum with me, the big half of the bongos. And Joe and I sat on the floor for 2 hours playing Indian music.
Were you dressed in white robes?
I don't think so. And we were doing okay. You know, people were stopping and, you know, appreciated it. I remember this really clearly. An Indian woman was heading down the aisle, and we thought, oh, shit. We're busted. So she stood there for a while, and she just beamed and then thanked us and left. So apparently she didn't know much about Indian music either.
Now, Faces is quite a dramatic change from Mona and
yeah,
My
it
Babe.
Is.
It's very psychedelic and
yeah,
progressive.
Yeah, it is. And when you listen to TC Atlantic's repertoire, Faces sticks out.
Yeah,
it's like nothing else the band ever did. It was very psychedelic. The hook kind of was that Fred's Farfisa got fuzzed. And I don't think he ran it through a fuzz tone box. I think there was a combination of stops on the organ that gave him that sound. But I might be wrong. He might have actually run it through a fuzz tone.
And the guitar had fuzz tone?
The guitar didn't have so much fuzz on it. When you listen to the guitar solo, it's fairly clean. The drone sound is all Farfisa. Da 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 da. That's all organ. The bass was very repetitive. The drums, though, were more straight four beat. There wasn't anything very Indian sounding about the drum part. But the whole thing had this bizarre sound. The lyrics were real nihilistic, sort of existential, you know. And it just all kind of worked. And we recorded it. It, you know, it got a lot of airplay again, and people liked it. But it was just a song. No, it didn't cause any huge waves that I remember. It was only later, years later, that song achieved kind of mythic status with people.
Right, when it was reissued on various compilations and
exactly.
So forth.
Yep, all the... I mean, I'd never heard the term garage band until I started seeing some of those things come out, probably in the 80s, maybe, or...
The first compilation of garage music came out in 1972
okay.
called Nuggets.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that one.
Produced by Lenny Kaye and released on the Elektra Asylum, or Elektra. And that triggered off dozens and dozens of other compilations throughout the 70s, 80s, 90s, up till today.
Yeah, they're still
and they
being
keep
released.
Coming.
They keep coming. And today, you know, if you Google Faces or TC Atlantic, people act like that song was this huge revelation. And I think the thing that catches people about it is it was so unexpected out of Minneapolis, from a Minneapolis band. If Minneapolis had a sound then, it was just very white, kind of distorted, pretty much all cover stuff. You know, Minneapolis hadn't really developed any kind of a sound. The only band that came out of here in that period that really went somewhere and had a sound, I think, was the Trashmen, who did very, very well with what they did.
Now, you played Faces live, I
yes.
assume.
Yes, oh yeah, yep.
How did that go over with the kids?
Fine. I mean, again, it was a danceable song, but I don't recall that we had any more requests for that than we had for, say, Mona. It was just a good song. It was really a strange one in our repertoire, although we were playing some other things then that were bordering on some of that new sound.
What would they have been?
We did You Keep Me Hanging On by Vanilla Fudge, their version of it. We were doing our own arrangement of Paint It Black by the Stones that I really liked and thought was pretty progressive. So we were starting to do some things that were pushing a little more that way. Joe, I think, was really interested in that sort of experimentation. He was, you know, moving the band that way a little bit. Bob wasn't necessarily in line with that, was kind of going another way. One of the things that made TC Atlantic interesting, I think, is that there were a lot of different musical tastes in the group, and what we played sort of reflected a lot of different tastes.
And the B-side on Faces was a song called Baby, Please Don't Go. What can you tell us about that?
It's an old blues song. It's been covered by a lot of people. And Fred did kind of an old blues man take on it. You can hear him, you know, intentionally slurring and mispronouncing words on the song.
Now, that record came out on Turtle. What do we know about the Turtle label?
I don't recall much about the Turtle label at all. I'm not sure who owned that label. I think it might have been Peter Steinberg.
Well, we know it was green and it had a
turtle on it.
So we know that much.
That's about all I can remember. You know, it's interesting that I don't remember who paid for most of those pressings. I think that they were paid for by Peter and B Sharp Music and Dove Recording Studios. I know the band didn't pay for the pressings.
And again, do you have any idea how many pressings there were of Faces?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I'd be surprised if it was more than a couple thousand.
And who made any money on it?
Nobody made any money on it. I know how much money I made on recordings.
Yeah, we all.
$5.79.
You got a check?
I got two checks.
From who?
From the TC Atlantic Live album, I'm pretty sure.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
And worse, well, we're on that subject, was the fact that people like Eva in France and all these compilation people would steal your music,
yep,
reissue it, and, you know, supposedly make a profit on those reissues, but the bands never got any of that money.
Right, that was a bootleg out of France
all
in 1983.
Bootleg, yeah. They bootlegged not only the record, they even copied the jacket, both front and back.
Yeah, they also, I believe, bootlegged the Litter and the Electras, mm-hmm, as well, so
yeah.
You're...
Among
good company there.
Yeah. Every band that's out there has been bootlegged.
Oh, yeah. Well, and sometimes it was with your permission. Things like, you know, KDWB would release an album once a year, Top Hits. There was Garrett Records, Heilacher Brothers release of, what was it called, the Twin Town Top 10
teen,
or something?
Teen Beat or
yeah.
Teen,
oh,
was,
teen Hits.
Big Hits of Mid-America.
Big Hits of Mid-America, and then Volume 2 and maybe 3.
It was Teen Hits 1, Teen Hits 2.
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, bands like the Underbeats and the Accents and the Ivanis and the Trashmen, Ravons, everybody were on those, and nobody ever got paid for those either.
Nope.
So nobody ever made any money doing this.
So Shake and Spanish Harlem were also released on the Turtle label,
on Turtle? Mm-hmm.
That looks like number 1105, and the previous one you did with Faces was 1103, so there was another Turtle 45 apparently in there in between those two, but we don't know who that is.
Nope.
What's the story on Orangutan? And The Whole World Knows When I'm in Love, released on Mercury by a band called The Pygmies.
The Pygmies. Peter Steinberg, Peter was really an interesting guy here. I mean, he played a huge part in Twin Cities music, and I don't think he's ever really gotten credit for it. And I think he deserves some credit because he was an enormous energetic hustler. He really wanted to make hit records, and he wanted to do it here in Minneapolis. He wrote, and maybe he had a partner helping him write, Orangutan, was meant to just be a bubblegummy top 40 hit.
Like a novelty song?
A novelty song. He wanted somebody to record it, and so he brought Fred, And I think the rest of TC Atlantic all worked on the session. Into the studio, we recorded it, and it was released under the name The Pygmies. TC Atlantic really didn't want to claim ownership of that song.
And it looks like that got released on a national label, Mercury.
Yep, I couldn't tell you how that happened.
Do we have a year when this was recorded?
I think it was in late 66, early 1967.
When this came out, did you hear it on the radio?
I honestly can't tell you if we did. I really don't remember.
And that brings us to another group with a different name, and that is Eric Marshall and the Chimes, mm-hmm. who recorded The Countess and I Can't Love You Anymore in 1967. But the rumor is Eric Marshall and the Chimes were actually TC Atlantic.
Well, it was certainly Fred singing. And again, I don't remember if we all recorded that song. Back then, again, because Peter was just trying to get a record recorded, he really didn't care who recorded it as long as he got a good sounding recording. So I may have played drums on that song. I really don't remember.
And I believe both songs were written by local songwriters Gary Pollock and Barry Goldberg.
Yep, young kids in high school at the time. I actually only met those guys in the recording studio. Mm-hmm. I never really knew them very well. I think they were very talented writers. They wrote 20 Years Ago in Speedy's Kitchen, which I know we're going to talk about in a minute. And I think that was brilliant writing. I think that was a really well-written song.
Well, I would certainly agree with that. So the next topic for discussion is TC Atlantic recorded live at the Bellray Ballroom, a whole album.
Mm-hmm.
What year was that recorded?
The summer of 1967. Nobody here had recorded an album live. There were cuts on a couple of other records that sounded live, but they were done in the studio with people in the studio clapping and making noise. Recording live is really a challenge for the recording engineer because in the studio you've got control over everything. When you're playing live, you don't have control over anything. And as the night goes on, bands tend to get louder and the crowd tends to get more raucous. So, you know, it's hard to get all that sound recorded without things distorting.
Who came out to record the band?
Arv did. We trucked the entire four-track machine, which was a big piece of equipment, a small mixer, a whole bunch of microphones. We spent the afternoon at the Bellray setting up, doing some sound checks, making some test recordings. And then we played through a whole regular night, a three-hour evening, and the whole thing was recorded. And I remember going back. The whole band went back to the studio that night after we recorded. And I'll bet we stayed at the studio till 3 or 4 in the morning. We listened to all the things right off the raw on mixed tape to see how it all sounded and what we liked, and started making some decisions about what might go on the album and what might not go on the album.
What did you think of the recordings when you first
You know,
heard
I think
it?
We were pretty pleased with it altogether. Listening to it today, the quieter songs sound really pretty good. A lot of the louder things, you hear all the distortion that got recorded. There's a couple songs that are standouts on the album. I think Smokestack Lightning is really, really good. Kind of wish we would have recorded that or released that as a single. Even from the live recording, I think that would have been a good single. Joe sings that. In retrospect, now, you know, 50 years later, I think Joe should have done a lot more of our lead singing. He was a really, really good singer. He had a very raw, bluesy sounding voice that I really found to be very, very appealing on record.
So on a typical night, Joe would only sing a couple songs?
A handful of songs. He did Mona, Smokestack Lightning. He might have done a few other lead songs, but mostly Fred did lead, Joe, Bob, and I did backup.
Let's run through the list of the songs on the live recording.
Okay.
You can just read off the name of the song.
On the A side, we started with I Think It's Gonna Work Out Fine. Then we did Mona, Spanish Harlem, and that turned out pretty good on the album too, I think. Don't Ask Me What I Say, that was sung by Bob. And then Smokestack Lightning, the song I just talked about that Joe did.
Okay, and on the B side?
On B we have Shotgun.
That's Junior Walker.
Junior Walker and the All-Stars. Stand By Me, that's that Benny King song. Shake, and then we ended with Love Light. That's how we ended almost every night on stage.
I think it's going to work out fine. Is that another? That's an old R&B song again,
yep,
right?
Yep. Yeah, a lot of R&B influence in there. I know, again, now in the modern age today when you can look up things on the internet, when people review that album, it's mostly favorable. They even though it's all covers, they remark on sort of the enthusiasm and the energy in the band, and they remark on the fact that there's so much R&B involved. That apparently that surprises people coming out of Minneapolis.
And that's on the Dove label, right?
On Dove, yep. Dove Recording Studios pressed and released that.
Was that the first album?
First and only, as far as I can remember.
The only album on Dove.
Uh-huh.
12-inch vinyl album.
12-inch vinyl.
TC Atlantic Live at the Bellray Ballroom.
Yep. And that's been reissued on a CD. Mm-hmm. I don't even remember who stole that. I know it was reissued on vinyl by Eva Records in France.
That's a bootleg again.
Bootleg. And it's been released on a CD recently, fairly recently.
I love that line. I can't remember who stole it.
Yeah. Here's another fun story. I used to live next door to a man who traveled around the world for business. And he came home from a trip to France. And he said, you know, I was with this guy, and we got to talking, and he found out that I lived next door to the drummer for TC Atlantic. And this is already, you know, 15 years after the fact. And he was so excited about it, because in France, apparently TC Atlantic is a very popular band. I love it. Why weren't we popular in France when I was playing?
That's a good story.